Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. When looking at 17th century Dutch genre painting, we see a story, recall a memory, or marvel at its craftsmanship and beauty. For some, there is yet another layer of experience in hearing these remarkable paintings. What kind of cadence do we see and hear? What is the timing and tempo of the music? What kind of major and minor keys do we see and hear? This lecture, given on December 5th, 2017, explores synesthesia and the lens of music to interpret selected works from the landmark exhibition Vermeer and the Masters of Genre Painting, Inspiration and Rivalry. On view from October 22, 2017 through January 21, 2018, the exhibition examined the artistic exchanges among Johannes Vermeer and his contemporaries from the mid-1650s to around 1680, when they reached the height of their technical ability and mastery of genre painting.
Seeing music in Dutch genre painting. Dutch artists, like so many of their predecessors or foreign contemporaries, peppered their paintings with depictions of music. They really would have had quite the orchestra if all of these people had been assembled together. But music transcends the merely representational embodiments of harmonies to something beyond the panel or canvas. In today's talk, we'll look at the tradition of musical depictions during this period in history and explore some of these representations. And then we're going to look at a topic not often associated with this time period. We'll finish by examining these works through a different lens, and I'll end with a challenge for you all. So let's start by examining the tradition of making and depicting music in the Netherlands during the 17th century. Most recently, the 2013 exhibition at the National Gallery in London, Vermeer and Music, The Art of Love and Leisure, paid close attention to the depictions of music making, instruments, and their symbolism in Dutch genre scenes, building upon other exhibitions and scholarship surrounding this theme over the last few decades in art history. During this period, music making was often a group activity, set in either the threshold of a tavern with a group of peasants, such as in the Adrian van Ostade in the upper left, at a kermis or fair where all classes join for merrymaking, such as in the Jan Steen painting in the upper right, or with the privacy of a set of friends in a collegium musicum, assemblies of the upper class, where they would gather to make music, as in this work by Joost Drugsloot in the center. This latter group would gather in a home or in a room in a city hall and engage in music making and conversation, sometimes even a few times per week. So popular was music making among those Dutch 17th century artists that nearly 10% of all Dutch 17th century paintings relate to music in one way or another, and there are really thousands of paintings, so we're talking a lot. Musical gatherings offered ways of expressing status in their action and being recorded by these artists. Recorded memories of celebrated Dutch statesman Constantin Huygens, shown here on the left in a painting by Thomas de Keyser, Huygens reflects that, quote, "No time is ever wasted when viol or song, flute or lute is used to make music." A sentiment true of these group settings in which the social status played so deeply into the interactions held over musical instruments or acts of music making. These musical gatherings brought together the same economic classes to create music, but also served, as was often the case for Huygens, to offer a shared space for discussing politics or solidifying international contacts. In fact, there's quite a bit of information on Huygens' employment of these gatherings to further his political agenda, using music as his vehicle. However, Huygens and other wealthy upper class were clear to make the distinction of amateurs playing and singing in either the collegium musicum settings or as pairs and trios in private settings, in private residences. They did not want to be confused with professional musicians who frequented taverns, pubs, and the like, the lowbrow, if you will. Rather, their musical gatherings were a bourgeois pastime and not a professional endeavor. Adrian van Ostade and others like David Teniers and Adrian Brouwer favored low-life musical genre scenes of lower class and peasants, a far cry from the more formal upper class citizens depicted by Droxlot. Now, if you're a 17th century viewer, and I want you to put yourself in that position for a moment, and you're viewing these works in someone's home, perhaps you're even thinking of a song, a musical chord, an association, a memory, or even a scent. I can assume that the scent of a peasant scene might be a bit more fragrant than the Droxlot. But these are all ways of connecting the different senses together, and I want you to try and think about that as we're looking through the rest of these paintings. Like the Collegium Musicum, the most well-known and successful Dutch genre artists, like Johannes Vermeer, who's up here on the screen, and Frans van Mieris, also make class distinctions, favoring trios, duos, and single-figure depictions of music, as in this painting from the National Gallery of London. Unlike Ostade, Brouwer, and Teniers, these high-life genre artists could align themselves with the upper class, thereby attracting more clients and showcasing their fine handling. In the tapestries draped from the ceiling, the artwork hung on the back wall, such as this painting by Gerrit van Honthorst, or the beautiful satins adorning their sitters. The more intimate setting of a private home is a more frequented subject for these Dutch genre painters in the later 17th century, where women and men of the upper class studied music. And what you're going to see most often in this exhibition, but also high-life genre scenes in the Dutch galleries, that is. In particular, these high-brow ladies who had plenty of time to perfect their musical studies, often devoting many hours per week to their craft, even though it was just a hobby, without the burdens of holding a job or tending the house. These wealthy, well-heeled women, bedecked in luxurious satins, are examples of the height of the upper class, as well as the height of Dutch genre painting. Further, the instruments that appear in these paintings, such as the intricately decorated virginals and well-crafted harpsichords, were very expensive and only available to those who could afford to own them. In Jan Steen's Young Woman Playing a Harpsichord to a Young Man, it depicts one harpsichord in the center, inscribed with a carefully rendered expression, "Actions prove the man," a nod to the implied couple's duet in the foreground and perhaps their budding romance, and to Steen's ability to depict this carefully created instrument. We can also see how carefully crafted these musical instruments were, such as in this example of a virginal from the Rijksmuseum. Clearly, these instruments were costly and a sign of the sitter's elite status, as well as the artist's status for accessing these instruments. The location of music making also makes for some suggestion of intimacy. Jan Steen's Ascanius and Lucelle sets the interior scene, which depicts a bed and therefore a level of intimacy, where a young woman and gentleman gather to play. Men and women making music together as a duet holds a dual meaning in these paintings, not only communicating the sitter's status in upper class society, but as representations of love. In Jakob Kat's celebrated Book of Emblems, Sinnen en Minnebeelden, one emblem reflects, who does not feel love? As a man tunes two lutes, he tunes one and the strings of the other begin to vibrate in unison, suggesting lovers' hearts beating in tandem. So duets here suggest harmony in relationships. We see these representations of music as signs of erudition, luxury, and love. The language of music was therefore well suited to artists interested in expressing these ideas in visual form. Remarkably, the language of music was also called upon by art theorists who sought to articulate the basic tenets of painting. In 1604, theorist Karl von Mander, a Dutchman, published his Het Schilderboek, the Painter's Book, which was a manual for artists, in which he describes how artists should seek to show balance in their compositions by expressing how, quote, just as in music, the multifarious sounds of the singers and the players harmonize, so here too, in painting, do the many different figures. So these Dutch artists, when depicting music, are searching for balance and harmony in their compositions and color choice. In Jan Steen's painting of a young woman playing a harpsichord, we see interest in luxury and amorousness expressed through a scene of music making. We also see von Maunder's recommendations for harmony in painting through his use of the nearly complementary colors of the yellow lake satin bodice next to the rich ultramarine of the blue woman's blue skirt in the foreground. And the harpsichord diagonals are complemented with the rounds of the spindles of the leg, the lute being brought down by the page, and the archway in the top. The way the artists are composing images of music through structure and color are meant to reinforce the subject. So what we see is harmonious in every sense of the word and meant to draw you as the viewer in. It is this all-encompassing idea of music and painting, from its subject to its structure, that I find so fascinating, and which to me begs the question, what about actually hearing music and painting? Well, think back to the last few paintings that we looked at and put yourselves once again in the shoes of your Dutch 17th century counterparts. Are you viewing this painting or these paintings in their home? What do you hear when you're looking at these works? What do you see in the shapes, and what do they cue you to see? What do the colors suggest while you're looking at them? And how do they make you feel? I'd like to focus next on a very distinct but related concept in art history that has looked at these relationships of color, space, and placement, but not particularly at these paintings. Synesthesia, a Greek term for syn or union, and aesthesis, or sensation, blends to create a union of the senses. And synesthesia occurs when one of the five senses, stimulation, triggers experiences in an unrelated sense. So, when you smell a scent, you hear a sound. Or in the case of hearing painting, for some, viewing paintings triggers hearing music, and likewise, those hearing music trigger seeing certain colors. Okay, I know, you must be wondering why we're looking at a 20th century painting by Vasily Kandinsky when this talk is about 17th century Dutch genre painting. I promise we're gonna come back to what we were talking about. We're going to go on a little trip first. Kandinsky was a self-described synesthete. In his case, sound triggered sight. In 1896, Kandinsky attended a performance of composer Richard Wagner's Lohengrin, which recalled to him a deep well of memories and emotions of the past, and which drove him straight to the canvas to visually express what he had heard. The violins, the deep tones of the basses, and especially the wind instruments at the time embodied for me all the power of that pre-nocturnal hour. I saw all my colors in my mind. They stood before my eyes. Wild, almost crazy lines were sketched in front of me. I did not dare use the expression that Wagner had painted my hour musically. These are really powerful words, I think, which really speak to the power of the visual arts and the musical arts for that matter. Now, synesthesia first appeared as a named condition back in the 19th century, but its foundations actually date much further back in time and place. So I'm gonna go over a brief history of that now. Buckle up. In about 550 BC, Pythagoras gave musical notes numerical value and established our natural notes. So what you may know of the eight notes C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C. A few hundred years later, in approximately 370 BC, Plato built upon Pythagoras' theories, and he wrote Timaeus, stating that, quote, the soul of the world is described as having these same musical ratios, defining the initial concept of the sensory overlap, as well as the link with the spiritual world. Here on the left, we have musical notes, and their proportions are in fractions, which is why it's not quite so beautiful as other things we've seen. This chart may not look at all related to color, but these numeric proportions provided the basis for Aristotle in 350 BC, who related that the harmony of colors was much like the harmony of sounds. Now, Aristotle solidified this foundation of fractions and mathematically articulating these musical notes for the correlation charts that would later emerge in the 1600s and beyond, and which marry certain musical notes devised by a Greek system of octaves or eight-note intervals with a light color. Skipping ahead a few hundred years, the German Jesuit priest Athanasius Kirchner wrote extensively on many subjects, including music theory. Among Kirchner's most important theories was his work on the correspondence of musical notes with specific colors, which he coded into a correlation chart and published in 1646. And this is an adapted form. Kirchner built upon these numeric ratios and translated them into musical terms, so diminished fifths for any of you musicians out there. According to Kirchner, deep, dark sounds of minor notes possess cool, deep colors, while the warmer, brighter sounds of major notes are warmer, lighter colors. For a Jesuit priest, the coexistence of sensory functions had profound implications in worship, and the immersion of sight and sound had the capacity to, as one scholar wrote, quote, move the passions to produce strong emotional effects that, under properly controlled conditions, could ravish the soul and lead the faithful more closer to the divine. Pretty strong there. Kirchner even devised plans for a color organ, beautifully illustrated here in a 1650 publication of his Musurgica Universalis. And this plate is from the holdings at the University of Glasgow. The idea behind this color organ would be that when a musical note was depressed, a certain color would be transmitted. And I'm going to circle back to this idea in just a minute. Kirchner's color chart was later expanded by Isaac Newton in his 1704 treatise on optics, in which he dealt with the parallel between the colors of the spectrum and the notes on the musical scale. In mathematical fashion, Newton divided the visible light spectrum into seven colors, which you can see his chart up here, and here it is in color, in which he also pointed out the mathematical relationships of these seven colors, similar to those in the musical scale, and then displayed them in an adaptation of Kirchner's 1646 chart, which I've also adapted here. Now, drawing harmonies between color and sound continued for centuries after this point, to Louis-Bertrand Castel, also a Jesuit monk, but from France, a physicist and a mathematician. He wrote a 1740 treatise, Optique de Couleur, or On the Melody of Colors. He devised a clavicon oculaire, or a light organ, on which certain notes sounded at that time would the prescribed color would illuminate, a modern take on Kirchner's vision. In the later centuries, the concept of a light organ actually materialized. In fact, you can even get a kit now and make your own. This is an example of one down here. But you could say that Kirchner and Castel were really the forebearers of the idea, and they really should have trademarked it. And this leads us to the present. This chart, created in 2004, maps the particular color suggested by each theorist for each musical note. And I should qualify this that this is Newton onward, so. It's truly striking to see that while there's not firm consensus around a particular color used for each note, there is a general progression. C's and D's are reds and oranges. E seems to often be yellow. F through G sharp holds mostly greens. And A and B has variations on pinks. Now, there's also been a great deal of neuroscience in the last 20 years on the topic of synesthesia. The graphic here well describes the development of the brain and that all the different senses belong to different areas of the brain, and when synesthesia is thought to occur, which is, according to this chart and in studies, likely in youth, when the senses start to separate from one another. So they begin kind of overlapping with one another, and then they start to move as we grow older. But when those connections remain and they actually don't separate, that's when synesthesia actually occurs. It's kind of an accident. A 2004 study of those claiming to have synesthesia looked closely at the sight-sound corollary in particular and found commonalities from study respondents in that higher, brighter pitch is often associated with lighter colors, whereas darker, deeper, minor tones project cooler, richer colors. Numerous musicians, from composer Alexander Scriabin to Lord, Billy Joel, and Stevie Wonder, to name a few, claim to be synesthetes as well. changing their song compositions to correlate with particular colors they associate with certain musical notes. An older estimate I was able to locate pointed to a range of 1 in every 100,000 individuals to 1 in every 5,000 are actually synesthetes of some variety, including some of you out here, I'm sure. But it's difficult to get an accurate count of those who actually have it because of the nature of synesthesia. It could be very mild, it could be quite pronounced, you could have it going multiple directions, 3 different senses, that is. And due to the fact that there are also 19 different types of synesthesia documented. So where does that leave us with hearing music in Dutch genre painting? For many viewers, the composition of a painting in terms of color and shape reinforce the subject matter, just like we saw with the stain. Subtly reinforcing the subject matter allows a painting to subconsciously draw us into a different world. In this exquisite painting by Gerrit Dou, we are invited to play, to join, to transcend the fact that we're viewing a work from a 21st century stance. We're truly transported here. In, for example, Vermeer's Woman with a Lute, we are perhaps curious about what she is about to play after she tunes the lute. The inviting cool dark tones with accents of warm light on the upper left of the wall invite us to peer into a private captured moment. We're drawn in by the masterful color composition, while the lady with her lute reinforces the oral suggestion of harmony and a balance. Now for a synesthete, the surrounding cast of Vermeer's Woman with a Lute may appear to be cool and dark, just like what you see, with a warm center beginning with a bit of light on the upper left of the wall, promoting the warm whites and creams to direct our attention to the face of the subject. And a synesthete might associate the pitch to be deep, with these cool dark tones present in the foreground, while the higher and brighter back wall and in the face of the subject suggest warmer major chords. The shapes in the composition, diagonals of the tablecloth and the shadow, paired with the gentle curves of the lute and the woman's face, so circles and ovals, create similar oral associations, such as sharp notes paired with a gentle resolve, or that is, moving musically from dissonance to consonance. That same 2004 study I mentioned earlier cited some of the commonalities to how synesthetes approach paintings. And in fact, most synesthetes associate the progression of paintings much like a musical score, from top to bottom, left to right. And here, the work opens with a major chord in the far upper right with a yellow from the daylight, and then the eye moves down through the diffused light of the wall to the darker registers, the minor chords, namely the deep blues. The cool white of the ermine trim of the woman's elegant coat collar could be a diminished chord, and the final resolve, the low cream and gray tile in the lower right. And for those of you who might not know a particular chord like the back of your hand, I'm going to play a period piece, Klar, Waar hebt u harte verlept? What has fated your heart? Which I probably just butchered in saying, sorry, Henriette. By Peter Cornelis Hooft, performed here by the Hauchens Duo. So right there is the major resolve in the lower corner. This musical piece, composed by Meckart, would have been likely the soundtrack to the lives of the subjects in these paintings, as well as the viewers of these intriguing scenes. However, these paintings need not be depicting music to convey their musicality. Though many viewers might describe certain paintings to be quiet and still, for some, hearing painting applies to even the quietest of scenes, such as Vermeer's Woman Holding a Balance. As my colleague Arthur has remarked, the subject matter and palette imbue a sense of silence and stillness. It is indeed quiet, though the subject matter of our sitter is potentially weighing souls, because The Last Judgment's in the background. It's hardly a light topic to cover. Even so, Vermeer's choice of palette yet again reinforces this quiet stillness. To a synesthete, however, this scene might appear differently. Hearing the minor chords repeated in the rhythms of the folds of dark blue cloth and repeated again in the diagonals of the lady's arm, perhaps the end of a refrain. And then finally, the narrow strip of warm, creamy wall in the upper corner, or in the lower right, sorry, offering a major resolve. I'm going to play another piece for you, a little section by Morten Lauritzen, O Magnum Mysterium. Admittedly, this is a favorite of mine. And if you haven't heard the whole piece, I highly recommend it. Particularly this passage. This piece is actually in D major, but the particular passage's introduction of an A sharp, for me, suggests this rich blue folds of the fabric in the foreground. Now, this piece is not a contemporary musical piece to Vermeer, or indeed the 17th century, but it is illustrative of the richness of sound that Kandinsky cited in his quote, and that von Maunder suggested that his students follow. I want to be clear here, though, I'm in no way suggesting that these artists were synesthetes. I haven't unearthed any information to tell me otherwise, but the thread of theorists' work from the 17th century, as well as their predecessors and their successors, affirm the concept of synesthesia, though unnamed at the time, would have had resonance with contemporary viewers to these works, just as it resonates with us in the 21st century. Now, Vermeer and his fellow Dutch genre painters followed traditions of harmony and balance in composing their masterpieces. Musicality of a painting is clearly so much more than just a painting depicting music. And with that, we can think of our own approaches to these paintings. To think of Kirchner's advice, we have to have a transcendent experience by blending sound and color. We can think of ways our eyes might approach these works. To that end, I'm going to present you all with a little experiment that hopefully will work. A 21st century synesthete might view these Dutch genre paintings with a different soundtrack than just the 17th century piece. Taking Vermeer's luminous Woman with a Pearl Necklace, I'd like to play two sections of a musical piece for me that reflect a color progression of this painting so beautifully. Both clips are from Coldplay's Life in Technicolor, and I invite you to look for the first time at the painting and then see if you can hear the same chords, or in the same key of A major, that is. You can hear this gradual crescendo build in the intensity of sound and volume, kind of like waking up. For me, it's reminiscent of moving out of the darker tones in the folds of her skirt and the lower registers of the table to the very small sliver of cream color in the vertical of her skirt. The second clip I'm about to play is from a little later in the same piece, where the build has happened and the crescendo has continued. This portion moves us to the upper half of the painting. It's a little different movement than I previously mentioned, from left to right, top to bottom. This time we're starting at the bottom and moving up through the woman's gaze as it directs us to the bright filtered light of the window. The soundtrack to view a work, a room, an exhibition, or even a museum is very much an individual experience this way. based on the colors that you see and the corollary sounds that you hear. The interplay between these arts does not need to be taken just at the face value of their individual experience, but in their symbiotic experience together. And I'd like to invite you and challenge you to wander through the galleries with this information bearing on your mind, but this time think about how you might construct your own soundtrack. Thank you very much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.